Hey everyone, my name is Mahesh, and this is Ampere Amplified. It's a podcast that we have here at Ampere to showcase our talent inside the company and share a little bit of what we do technically and culturally. This episode, we're going to be talking with a couple of mechanical engineers about what mechanical engineers actually do at a silicon startup. So I have two folks here. One of them is Kate Murray, who is an intern in the MEC-E team. She joined us from Oregon State University. Hello, Kate.
Hello.
And also here is one of her mentors, Josh Levy, who is a principal engineer in the mechanical design team.
Thanks for having us.
Awesome. All right, Kate, do you want to get us started?
Okay, sure. So to start, Ampere is primarily a silicon company, but you're a mechanical engineer. So what do you think the hardware platform team that you're on, and as a mechanical engineer, what do you think your team and you do that provides the greatest impact for the company?
From the outside, it looks like we're a system design team, and we are that, but also the more important aspect of it, when we design a system 2 years or 3 years in advance, we can give feedback to the silicon architecture team or the sales and marketing team about what we can do in the future. We can also look at what we need to understand in the future. But I think the impact that we can have on like TDP of the product or the efficiency of the VRs or something like that, those are probably our biggest value adds to the company.
And when you say system, are you talking about just everything inside the chassis or the chassis itself, the server?
Yeah, so when we talk about different levels of integration in servers, there's kind of a standard, like L3 is just the sheet metal and the mechanical parts. L6, you start to put in the baseboard and maybe a backplane, maybe PCI risers. L10, you've got software involved now. There's higher levels that have to do with a rack or a whole row in the data center. But I'm talking about L6 to L10 in there. Yeah.
What are these L levels that you're talking about?
Yeah, these are just standard industry integration levels. What happens at each level of integration of the system? So L1 might be like cutting out sheet metal parts, right? And you just have a pile of parts that aren't bent right. They're not riveted together. By the time you get to level 3, you've actually got your chassis is put together. All the rivets are in place. You know, you can thread in all your fasteners. You might even have some level of cabling and test done at L3, depending on the architecture of your system. And then it progresses higher. We used to, when I was at my previous company, we used to talk about L9 as kind of our ready to go system level. Like this is what we consider our product. I think people here talk about L10, which has to do with software, which is very important for us. So we kind of focus on the L6 here. Interestingly, Ampere does most of the integration between L6 and L10 by ourselves. So we'll like install the memory, or we'll, you know, spec out what the platform config is in terms of PCI cards or other add-ons. And that is what goes to the customer, not what we're getting directly from our ODM partner.
So you're talking about some just industry standards and the whole L3, L6, sure. All those systems. There are a lot of industry standards, it seems like servers being 19 inches wide and the whole 1U and 2U systems. How do those constrain what you do, thermal solutions and other mechanical factors, and how does that impact your work?
Yeah, so for me personally, the most critical piece of data that we get out of the 19-inch rack is the width of the system. Especially difficult these days because we have very large sockets and the number of memory channels just keeps going up and up and up. So fitting two sockets with 12 channels of memory and two DIMMs per channel across a whole chassis is very, very difficult in this day and age. Some of the industry is actually moving towards a single socket as their source. There's also some thermal constraints that come about from some of this. I think it's either our customer requirements, or there's another spec out there, ASHRAE, that defines the temperature that the air leaving the hot side of the server can be. And if you look at how big that wind tunnel is, how much airflow you can get through there, and that temperature, there's a limit to how much you can cool with air in that box. And it's right around, I don't know, 3,000 watts, maybe 4,000. And so you might take the CPU power right off the top, right? If you have one socket, then you have a lot more time that we can use air cooling. If we have two, we're kind of getting near the wall right now. Because if you take, 1,000 watts out of 3,000, you have not much left for the rest of the platform. That's just physics, that boundary, right? Physics and the requirement of the air temperature. So it's pretty interesting. I think we're going to actually do some communication about that to explain some of the stuff to the higher level architecture folks.
So the choices that we make to optimize that small wind tunnel have to scale up for like the entire rack?
There are some differences in like temperature from top of rack to bottom rack. Some data centers have like a raised floor where they can put some extra cool air in the bottom. But there's not a lot of these boundary conditions that have a higher level requirement than like L9 or L10. There's rack. How heavy is the rack if you're going to ship it anywhere, right? How stable is it to seismic activity or even just the tons and tons of fans that are running in that data center? Everything's vibrating. But yeah, I think ASHRAE is a really good spec that we get a lot of stuff like that out of. I think they have an acoustic limit there too. But most of the temperature limits come from our toughest customer requirement, right? And if you think about it, if you're sourcing a bunch of servers from a bunch of different sources, you want a spec in your data center to know that this isn't going to wreck this whole row because it's too hot, right? Everything that goes into any slot in any of these racks is going to perform in this envelope. So we can build our facility around that.
How does the material you use for the chassis impact any of that, or does it? Or how do you choose the material for the chassis?
So for the most part, we use this kind of steel that's called SGCC. It's based off of a spec out of Japan, JIS. I'm not good with acronyms, you know that. And SGCC is a cold rolled steel that is hot dipped to galvanize it. There's an electroplated version of that, but it's more expensive, right? Because it's harder to electroplate to deposit stuff on the surface than it is to just dip it. It's steel. It's relatively strong. The strength to weight ratio is good for the kind of products we're making. It's widely available and it's not super expensive. Anytime we have an issue, someone's going to go throw a stainless steel part at it, which makes the part cost like 5 times more. Even if they didn't do any analysis, they're just like, oh, something here is breaking, stainless steel, which is like a good first level approximation of fixing a mechanical problem. But you'll see it in your career. Like someone always is, well, we'll just use stainless for that. Well, does that actually change the modulus or the yield strength? What does it change? And all steels have the same, pretty much the same modulus. So they all bend about the same amount as you put the same amount of force on them. But the yield strength, where they actually start to neck and then break, right, the top of the stress strain curve, those are way different for all of those. And even in like 300 series, 301 stainless, there's a bunch of different tempers. So it's basically like, I think it's how hard they cold work it, and it gets stronger and more brittle. So it can have a higher ultimate tensile strength, but a lower yield. Yeah. And so we use SGCC because it's got good properties and it's relatively blemish free over a 5-year lifespan, which is about how long servers are warrantied for. Somebody out there might make a stainless steel chassis. They probably would only do it if they had a big reason, like this is going to be mounted in an aircraft carrier or something like that.
Are the electrical or magnetic properties of the material that important for a server chassis, or?
Most of them are, most of it's going to be iron and steel. So it's going to have the same kind of properties of radiating. If you went to a totally different metal, the size of your holes would probably change, right? Because different metals conduct differently. But yeah, it's pretty much standard based on just its availability and its durability.
Hey, Josh, can you do me a favor? I'm trying to figure out how to dampen the noise of you banging on the table a little bit.
I can just not hit the table.
You could not hit the table.
Sit on my hands.
You could try to do that. See what happens.
Do you want me to leave it here?
You can move it back. It doesn't matter. It's like a snap.
Well, actually, Kate can run that analysis for you.
I actually got an
this table.
I got an output finally. That
yeah. Oh, nice.
Yeah.
What'd you get an output on?
I'm doing a modal analysis of a heat sink for the VRTT to see when it's vibrating too much from the fans. And I finally got an output from our software. So.
Oh, cool. Is there some resonant frequency that we shouldn't run the fans at?
That's what I'm finding out.
Okay.
We'll see.
Yeah. Everything is like a guitar string. and it has different notes that it's going to sing at, right? So anything you can model it in the software we have and determine without even knowing what the forces applied or any boundary conditions, just what those frequencies are, right? It's just all geometry, right? So Kate is using that tool to understand whether this fan is coupling to this heat sink and making it shake.
Okay.
Right? And if we find that that's the source, then we can go in and say, okay, it's at these frequencies. We can do something to damp those frequencies out. It's a pretty cool project. You know, I used to do a lot of modal analysis on circuit boards because it's a really fast way of understanding like the stress and strain under some kind of dynamic event, usually a shock or a vibration. And you would get all these cool like drum head shapes of the board, right? All the different modes. Maybe it's kind of like going up on one side and going down, or maybe there's four sections because it's just, you know, and you get to see all that cool stuff and how moving something stiff around on the board can change where the modes are. And
like a connector or something.
Exactly. You can use connectors to like, you can put a connector in the middle of a high deflection region and fix that. But it's like a hitting a puddle with a hammer, right? The energy in the board goes somewhere else. You may have made the energy worse by doing that. But that's the kind of stuff that I was working on before I came here.
It's interesting. Where did you work before you came here?
I worked at Intel for 14 years.
Wow. Do you have any good war stories from your time over at Intel? Any nasty interactions with vendors?
I've actually got a good one. This is more of a public relations snafu that I was involved in. So Intel has this, I don't know if they still have it. I think they do. They had this thing called the Developer Forum, and they would often host it at this place called the Moscone Center in San Francisco. They would just always keep coming back to the same place. And I didn't know what kind of event this was. When I heard Developer Forum, I thought, oh, these are going to be our customers that are looking to learn how to use our stuff. Right? That is not what it is. It's a press event. So every person in the audience is from some like blog, like On and Tech or some, you know, Serve the Home, like, which we love. They give us great reviews and they're very honest. So I was talking to someone after my presentation. It was a presentation on skin limited devices and how if you change a device from like a PC to a tablet, all of a sudden all of your surfaces that you're touching have changed. So we were talking about how to deal with that. And this guy comes up to me and he asks me about Apple products and what I think about them. And I, you know, off the cuff, I'm like, well, you know, they're ID first and maybe they're not focused on thermals. Apple doesn't care about thermals. This is the head of the article he wrote. I got a call from the GM of that division. Was like, what is this? And I was like, oh, no. So, I spent like a whole night fretting and like calling my boss and it ended up, I mean, I don't know if you can still find that article anywhere. I'm sure somewhere like the Internet Archives, it's still there. But that was the last press event I ever did in Intel.
So the takeaway is when you go to a press event, know that anything you say can be quoted.
Or even
out of context.
Better,
out
know
of context.
Your audience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Know whether or not you're going to a press event.
That's funny. Kate, where were you before you came to Ampere?
I was at Oregon State University.
Nice.
Studying mechanical engineering with an aerospace minor.
What's the engineering dorm now?
There's a bunch of them. I was in Holly Hall.
Holly.
There's also Buxton. And.
Oh, so it's all the quad?
It's only those two in the quad. The other two are, I'm not sure what the other two are. I think they might be general or business.
I was down in the McNary complex.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I think Rogers. Rogers fifth floor.
Oh, yeah. Rogers. Wait, that's not a dorm, though.
That's not a dorm. That's
The engineering, that's the engineering building.
Well, I spent a lot of time on the fifth floor there,
too. It was your dorm.
Yeah. I remember, you know, being in the computer lab sometimes at the middle of the night, like, because something was due the next day.
Well, talking about school, what led you to want to study mechanical engineering?
I was a physics major for my first 3 years at Oregon State. And after my sophomore year, I got a internship with the National Science Foundation. It's called REU, Research Experience for Undergrads. And I went to UNLV, which is in Las Vegas, and I worked on an optics experiment under Dr. David Shelton. He was doing like long-range correlation of movement in fluids. Basically, we were shooting heavy versions of like deuterated or tritiated chlorine or chloroform or whatever. We were shooting it with an IR laser to try and see if we could detect movements in the fluid far away from where the laser hit, right? The laser would hit somewhere and cause like some cavitation and whatever. I spent my entire internship playing with the laser table and building components for the laser table in the shop, letting the other guy do all the data analysis about the actual experiment. I fixed some ways that they clean out their little test carpools. I just enjoyed the building way more than the science. So when I came back, I switched my major. And then, you know, the rest is... I think I have a strong physics background, right? Which helps for any discipline, but mechanical is so, like, it touches so many different things. It's really good to have all of that.
There's a big tangible aspect to mechanical engineering that folks like us in computer science don't have.
Yeah, engineer's Christmas. You guys don't get that.
Yeah.
We get all of our parts. Oh, we got to collect them all up and put them together and go play with them for a couple hours right when they show up.
When I come down and look at your desk, you have cool things on your desk that are related to your job. And you look at my desk, I have like little figurines and stuff that are like nothing to do with like what I do.
Yeah. We're seen as like the handyman.
Yeah.
You know, because it's all tools. Especially at a silicon company, everybody, it's all about how close you can get to the silicon.
Yeah.
Right. We're not very close to the silicon. Except maybe a little bit in the beginning to define the TDP. And that's always like a lot of mechanical engineers that I've worked with at silicon companies have lamented that a little bit. Like it's hard to be in, have that role of being like a secondary citizen to electrical engineers and stuff like that. But I think we can kind of do our job in a vacuum and then come present the findings, and we don't have people looking over our shoulder. And
but do you feel that's how it is at Ampere, or is it more of a collaboration?
If I go back to my previous role, I heard a person very senior in marketing say, "Why is this so difficult? It's just a metal box." That hurt.
Yeah.
Here, I think everybody is really happy to have us here, and we're making a lot of impact. But it's still like I would have to explain a stress versus strain curve probably to most folks around here, which is like the basics of what we do.
Like the first thing you learn when you start materials.
Yeah, which is okay. I mean, that's why you hire a mechanical engineer, for someone to think about that.
Yeah.
It seems like there's more and more a gulf between mechanical engineering and any other discipline. But I think there's ways that we're overcoming that. I mean, if you look at like the 3D printing folks that all are hobbyists there, they're all those engineers and even just people who don't have degrees yet they're learning software, right? A lot of those slicing engines are open source at the beginning. They're learning about thermal stuff because if different parts of the model cool at different rates, you have all kinds of curling and things detaching from the build plate. So I don't think mechanical is ever going to go away because at some level, you're always going to have to interact with something. And that's mechanical size, right? Yeah.
I'll share that. You know, I have a personal interest in your work, mainly because my dad was a mechanical engineer.
Cool.
So I learned a lot as I was growing up. And my degree actually is in quote unquote engineering. And so when I went to school, we didn't have a separation of like computer engineering, electrical engineering.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I've taken statics and dynamics and material science, the bridge building class. And I think that was my elective. I could have taken fluid dynamics, but that was way too much.
Yeah, that's a big jump.
This is kind of different.
Tough.
So I took like the trusses class instead.
Did you take thermo?
I did. I took thermodynamics, and we built a power plant for one of our final projects.
That's cool.
Yeah. So in Maple, right?
So, oh, okay. Yeah. Maple.
We just studied air conditioning and heating units.
Yeah. I remember the OSU physics department uses Maple for everything, and all the engineering departments use MATLAB.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Even though they're not the same thing, right? Because Maple's like one line at a time, kind of like Python. And then you kind of, I don't know, MATLAB kind of has to be compiled. It kind of, it's just a little bit different, right?
So I went back for my reunion, and I saw the thermal professor I had, and I shook his hand, and I'm like, thank you for making us do that project class on the power plant. Like I learned so much more than I don't remember anything else that you actually taught us, but I remember the project because I've always been like a project guy.
Yeah.
And I said, if you want to try to bring that class into the 21st century, you know, I don't know what project you're doing now, but you should try working on a data center and figure out what the PUE should be of that data center.
Right.
That's like a really large project that deals with many disciplines and yeah. something that, you know, the folks in this room, like, you know, we can look at the elephant from like one direction, but like you need experts from all around to understand, like, how do you get the PUE down in the data center?
Yeah. And you would think there'd be a lot of overlap between like HVAC style, like data center level thermal engineers and like the stuff that we're doing here at like system level, but they use totally different tools.
Yeah.
There's a lot more about like, you know, the boundary of the built, like the data center, like things going in and out of the actual data center, as opposed to just in and out of a box. It's interesting. There's not a lot of overlap there. Cause I know some facilities HVAC people and they don't, you know, there's not a lot of overlap, which you would think it's the same physics, right? It should yeah. go the same way, but there's a lot of specialized tools around electronics cooling and specialized tools around facility stuff. And there's a bit of a gulf there, which is exactly like where the ME stands, right?
Yeah.
In that gulf.
Yeah.
That's interesting. How did you, so you were talking about how it's a little bit difficult to be a mechanical engineer in like a server or like a silicon company. But you worked at Instar first and then you came here. So what drew you into kind of the server industry?
I was a mobile device guy. I spent a lot of time in the beginning of my career working on reference, like form factor references. So we would basically, you have a bag of parts that the marketing team gives you and you have to go make it in the smallest, coolest little device, right? So maybe the device folds in a unique way or uses like a foldable screen or it's a clamshell or it has a little keyboard that pops out from the back. So we had to go kind of put some legwork behind all of those concepts before they could show them off at trade shows, basically. And I spent a lot of time doing that. And then they changed direction in my division. And I was talking to a colleague who was like, you should apply for our group. So that was Doug Bennett, who was actually one of my mentors when I was in MECOP.
What's MECOP?
MECOP is actually, Kate, what's MECOP?
MECOP is a program that as a student you apply to from a bunch of universities kind of in the Northwest. You apply to it and there's a bunch of companies that are looking for interns. And so you go through an interview process with those companies and the companies rank which interns they like. And then the intern is assigned to the company. And the MECOP program gives the students 2 paid 6-month internships and it gives the companies just a quality group of interns to choose from to try out for their company and get some work done. I think it's been pretty helpful at Ampere, growing at least, to be able to try out some new graduate-ish people.
It's a great program. As an alum of the program, I'm probably a little bit biased, but the way that they partner with industry is a little bit unique, right? Like they have there's a committee at MECOP that's industry reps like myself talking to them about the curriculum that they're teaching the engineers. There's a committee about, you know, equity, inclusion, and diversity, like how to infuse the program with more of that. There's a lot more interaction between the industry people and the school, I feel like. And the students, I mean, graduating with a year of experience on your resume, it's like the joke of, we need 8 years experience in this piece of software that came out last week. You can never have too much experience on your resume. And then the screening process that they do is pretty intense. I mean, to get into the program, you have to do a panel interview with like 10 to 20 industry reps. And these are like sophomores and freshmen in college. It wasn't easy. Yeah. It's not easy now, especially dealing with having to do everything on like Zoom calls now. Mm-hmm. It's intimidating to have like 10 engineers in front of you firing questions at you.
Yeah. Well, even like the final interview when it's like, what, 15, 20 companies.
Yeah.
With a representative each and they don't even have time to each ask a question. They choose like, what, five people.
I think.
So you went through this for Ampere.
Right.
What was your experience like?
It was just kind of a blur, actually, because there was like, if I remember right, there was kind of a mingle or like a informal interview kind of a thing.
We had a, what do they call it? So when they did the live events, they would have kind of like a career fair.
Yeah.
I think after all of the interviews, maybe the same week, but after everything. When we did it through Zoom, yeah, they were like, set up your digital room, like your digital kiosk, and people and students would come in and ask some questions and then leave. And we had a lot of people interested because we're a younger company. It's only our second year. But that was interesting, right? Having people jump in and out all the time. You're like, oh, who's here? Can I write down your name? But then, yeah, the interviews, it's like a day long.
It's one or 2 days. Yeah. Especially for mechanical.
Yeah. Mechanical has a lot of engineers. So there's several different rooms. And you try to, if you're taking a mechanical engineer, you don't want to miss any of the students that are interviewing, right? So you have, if there's four rooms going on at once, you have to pull three other engineers out of their job that day, which is a big commitment, right? But we get really awesome interns. So I think at the end, it's totally worth it. Yeah. Every single intern we've had so far has been stellar.
Excellent. He's talking about you.
Thanks. Yeah, it's a really cool program. Yeah.
I honestly don't understand why there's not copycat programs all over the country.
I don't know.
It's such a good program. There's other co-ops, but they're not like, there's not as much engagement with industry. There's not as much like, this is our program. Everybody should know about it. It just seems like we're really lucky that that's going on in Oregon. And it is, it's Oregon Institute of Technology, Oregon State University, Portland State University, and University of Portland.
Let's see. What is the most difficult part of your job here at Ampere, and what is your favorite part?
The most difficult part of my job at Ampere has been giving unfortunate news in customer forums, which I've had to do, you know, a few times. That's very hard, especially important customers that you don't want to disappoint. But often, you know, things are out of your control and someone has to just grin and bear it and be the person to give the bad news. What do I really like about being here? I really love interacting with you guys and being part of MECOP. I think that was like the first thing I wanted to do when I came here.
Did you start the interaction, MECOP interaction with Oregon State from Ampere?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I was a mentor when I was at Intel. And then when I came here, I was like, well, we got to get involved, right? Yeah. So I called up the director and we did a bunch of interviews and we did a virtual walk around and so they could see the facility. And yeah, it's going into year three.
How would you like to see Ampere evolve over the next, you know, year, 3 years, 5 years, you know, just as it grows and becomes a more mature company?
Yeah, it's interesting. Some of the benefits that our products really provide. And I think if you were to take a step back and look at just reducing the amount of power consumption in the data center, we're like, that's a tangible good thing to do, right? If we can continue moving down that direction, not just saying, oh, you know, next year we'll just increase the TDP by 50 watts and we do that every year forever. You know, eventually you have to say, this is our limit and we're going to perform better under that mark, that limit, which we'll have to see eventually, right? So it'd be nice to see us make just double down on that philosophy of we just want to be the most optimized performance per power that there is.
Do you think about power per like physical area? Like when you think about like our 1U servers and 2U servers, so the 2U, your wind tunnel is larger, mm-hmm. so you can probably dissipate more heat. Amazon is doing this thing where they put like three smaller mini servers in one 2U chassis. Where do you see the industry going with regards to like power density, with regards to like use?
There's two things. I'm going to talk about the difference between like your overall system cooling and your heat density, right? So when you have heat density, like the silicon chip on the processor is probably the highest source of heat density, right? It's not going to be evenly distributed there. There's going to be some cores that are heating up more. Maybe there's like a bunch of cores in one corner. And so your hotspot is offset and now your thermal solution's working extra hard. So heat density is all about trying to get a uniform temperature over as much surface area as possible. And then cooling is taking that heat that's now, you know, you can get at it very efficiently because it's spread over the fins of your heat sink. And then using convection to remove that from the system. What was the rest of the question?
So some companies are, let's say, putting like two or three systems like sideways in a rack.
Yeah.
Right. To try to increase density that way. But maybe, you know, there's some trade-off.
Yeah.
In doing that.
So it's actually, you can kind of see this. Europe has a premium on floor space. So most of the data centers in Europe are using some amount of liquid cooling if they're not completely liquid. In the US, floor space is a little bit less costly, but you can start seeing the transition. So a lot of the high-end AI, HPC, machine learning workloads, those systems are starting to switch over to having some amount of the heat captured by liquid. Because that physics problem we were talking about before, right? You're limited through convective cooling. Well, now you just added another working fluid, right? You have air and whatever your coolant in the liquid cooling lines are. You can start getting out more than the air boundary condition. Yeah. And eventually, you have to go there, right? You hit a wall. You just can't remove any more heat with air cooling. So we'll probably start looking at that here pretty soon. What percentage of the heat can we remove with liquid? But then if you go to our customers in China, there's just tons and tons and tons of room. Like they're building all the time. They want air cooling. They want it to be, they don't care if it takes up a lot of room. Like if we went to 3U, it probably wouldn't be that big of a deal. I think the standard 2 rack units that they're using now is just because it's a standard, right? It's a lot of systems are that size. Like we can't get away and just drop an air cooling solution. And we need to start looking at liquid cooling. And liquid cooling is a very big arena, and you want to take baby steps in. The future is looks like Europe, and we're not getting rid of the past because it looks like PRC, right? So we kind of have to design on multiple fronts.
You had mentioned the CPU is probably the biggest draw of power. I think the second, maybe close to the second biggest draw is the DRAM.
Yeah, I'd agree with that because you probably have 300 or 400 watts.
Depending on how many is populated, how many sticks you have populated.
Yeah.
Do you ever see customers looking for custom thermal solutions to dissipate that heat or something special? Or like what are the trade-offs there of having not so off-the-shelf
solutions? I've worked on a thermal solution that cooled the memory as well as the CPU. Your fluid transfer lines have to get pretty thin, which means they get pretty delicate because the pitch on memory is very tight, right? I think right now we're using 7.2 millimeters for most of it. So that's the socket, the DIMMs, and the air gap is 7.2 millimeters. So it gets difficult to just get things down in there to touch the actual chips on the DIMM stick. But you can do it. I've seen people use these thermal interface materials that have like a sheet of plastic on the outside. So they're really conformable, but also like slippery. Because if you use a regular gap pad kind of TIM, and then you try to remove and install new DIMMs when your DIMMs die, you have to replace the whole thermal solution, which would be like 4 banks of memory and 2 CPUs or whatever. But yeah, there's places where that, you know, is going to be a challenge too. I think as we start to pivot to single socket, because there's plenty of cores for all the memory that's hanging out there, we can probably start to spread the memory back out again. But then there's just going to be more channels of memory coming in bigger sockets. Yeah. So it's going to be the same kind of issue.
Yeah. And as a computer architect, I want to have the memory as close to the CPU as possible.
Right.
Because that'll increase performance. Yeah. So now you have this trade-off of, well, I can't cool it, but...
Yeah. Yeah, you might not be able to run at your top bin speed if you're now spacing out the memory more, right?
Yep.
It's always cross-functional impact, right? And that's why it works so closely with design, thermal. We're starting to have structural analysis, and then our electrical team, right?
Yep.
Basically, layout and noise layout team in VDC and our team are the same. Like, we work together constantly. We have forums that are just standing where we talk every week, several of them. But yeah, it takes all of those disciplines to make it work. Definitely.
I know someone mentioned there was a system that in order to get more room, they did like a multi-layer, 2 boards or something to have like 2 sockets, like one on top of the other.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that would ever be something that Ampere would do? Or is it, or what are the challenges with that? Why is that not something that's common?
Yeah, so there's lots of challenges to that. I mean, aside from the mechanical challenge is just holding one board floating over another, right? There's our sockets talk to each other, and you need to communicate back and forth between the top board and the bottom board, where usually we just do it, you know, side to side through the board. Those are going to be cables probably, or some kind of stacked mezzanine connector. How is that going to look? Like, you now you have to design these custom super high speed cables, right? You can't just use standard like MCIO or sliver, because they need to be like swizzled. So like pin one here needs to go to the end pin here. Crossover cable, right? So you can't buy these off the shelf. You have to make them. And making custom cables is a nightmare.
Would rigid flex be an option to have like the two rigid boards and then just a flex between them?
Yeah, but at those sizes, that starts to get really expensive. It definitely could do it. You could just have the two boards be one. But yeah, I don't think it's that the industry is set up to make those kind of giant server boards with flex layers in them. Not saying it couldn't happen. I'm sure someone's done it. But yeah, they tend to try and keep the boards as cheap as possible, like still using through holes that are plated, as opposed to, you know, doing everything surface mount wherever possible.
I guess once you start thinking about that mezzanine and the little flex cable in between them, you also have to take into account your model of the vibration. Mm-hmm. And would that little flex cable come off easily?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, the flex cable is actually a part of the rigid board, right?
Yeah, about one of the layers in your board being polymer, and then just making that layer bigger than the board. And so you have a tail that's a flex circuit. I've seen a couple flex circuits designed into servers. Mostly they're like trying to get signals that it's really expensive to get the kind of signal integrity for like maybe USB 3 or something. So we soldered a TwinX to a flex cable so we could run the high speed signals through the TwinX and run all the rest of the low speed sideband stuff through the flex circuit. That flex circuit was really expensive. Mm-hmm. It was not a simple design. It probably would have been easier for us to just come up with a different solution. But you know, you run out of time. You got to have something that works.
Let's see. So something I was wondering about that's kind of separate from like a career engineering thing, but do you have any engineering projects that you work on outside of the office, or anything you've worked on like at home just for fun?
Yeah, I have. I made a homemade lathe once that I was using to try and turn a desk leg for my daughter's desk, but it was an IKEA desk. And it ended up being kind of a hassle. So I went and just found one online and bought it. I use CAD a lot to like design stuff around the house, like my back fence, which I built with a friend. I designed that all in CAD and had like a bomb, and I knew exactly what I needed to go buy at the store. And then I have some friends that do the Gambler 500, which is like an Overland rally. And we build a lot of low quality custom components for the car, because it's kind of like you're supposed to get the car for $500 and then do everything yourself. So like we made a mounting rack for some traction boards this summer, and I was in, you know, doing Ace Hardware engineering, where you're just walking around the section with all the bolts and stuff and trying to fit things together. They called me like, you've been gone for an hour and a half. I'm like, do you want it to work or not? So, and then I used to be into 3D printing, but it's, you know, I don't have as much time for that anymore, but I have some friends that do it still. It's always interesting to hear what's going on. I'm trying to get us a 3D printer for our lab here, which would allow me to get back into it, but we'll see.
I know Jeremy was pretty against that when Jordan suggested it.
He doesn't. If it's not on a circuit board, it has no value to Jeremy. That's not true. He likes to write. But yeah. No, I talked him into putting some in the budget for that. Undisclosed mechanical things for the lab, right?
I want to turn that question around too. Why don't you share what a mechanical engineering student does in their spare time?
Oh, okay. Let's see. So I'm also an equestrian. So over one summer, I made a robotic horse out of wire and string. And that was really fun, but I had no programming skills except for MATLAB. So I had a CS friend who was going to program it, but then she changed her major and never did. So now I just have this horse sitting on my desk that works mechanically, but it has no programming. So it just sits there.
What's driving it? Like an Arduino or something?
Yeah, it's just all Arduino components. Those
are mostly analog. You can figure it out.
Well, now I can. I just have it. But the real problem, the reason I couldn't program it, which I guess maybe I could use this, I don't know, but since I was running on a MacBook Air, I didn't have the plugin to like do it, and I didn't have any of the software because it was Mac, so that was the second problem.
Yeah. I've already gotten in trouble about talking about Apple. I'm not going to go back there.
That was interesting. It just has these four motors on each of like the mm-hmm. like the top of the leg joints, and then it just has I put it for some reason it like comes with a propeller thing on it, so I just kept that on and then ran a string through like these wires, and then I just made a joint out of wire and then connected it all the way down the foot, so when you like turn it forward it like lifts its knee up.
Cool.
That was really fun to design, actually. And then I started designing a dragon, but I never actually made that one, so yeah. But no, I have a lot of like weirdly diverse interests. Like I cultivate orchids, and I've written a couple books that have yet to be published, but I think it's fun to do. And I play instruments and stuff, so.
Cool.
Yeah, just a bunch of random things that I enjoy doing.
Yeah.
I've really enjoyed learning about cars, but that's just kind of a YouTube thing, because, you know, it's kind of an expensive hobby to get into, but.
I have a friend, and if you ask him what his mechanical engineering hobbies are, he will say, I do that to get paid. All of his hobbies are not related to that in any way.
That's funny.
Whatever. Yep. Yeah. Do what you like on your free time, I say.
Yeah.
It's nice if you're passionate about what you're doing for a living, but.
I really enjoyed designing things to connect mechanical engineering and equestrian stuff, because all of their technology is very behind, so I'm looking into ways to improve it.
They're still riding horses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, how was the Friday Smash Bros. Activity created?
Now that is an important question.
It is.
So our first two Meetup interns, Lester, who we hired, and then Chris, I think they were talking about it at lunch one day, and I was like, well, you know, my daughter just got that game. I like to play it. And so we decided to bring it in the next day, which was a Friday. And then it was somebody just walked by and sat down and started playing with us. So just kind of organically, we're like, okay, we're going to just do this every week. And we started doing lunches, and then we created a Teams channel for it. I think we probably get like 5 or 6 people regularly. I've been a little lax on it lately. I was traveling, and then Lester was traveling. But I think we'll try to make sure it happens at least 3 times a month.
It's cool that you're creating culture, and as new people join, they're like, yeah, I know how to play that one. Let's come and kick your ass in a little bit.
I would play other games if people don't want to play that one. There's a bunch of multiplayer games.
I've seen you play
games.
Mario Kart. And,
yeah.
Have you guys done Mario Party yet?
I don't have that one. Don't ask Lester. Maybe we should. We did Street Fighter one time, but it's only 2 people, so it's kind of like you have to do a tournament, which means it's extra competitive, which makes it not as fun.
Yeah. What's your favorite character?
In which one? Oh, it's the same in both. Ryu.
I was a Street Fighter guy.
Yeah.
Street Fighter 2 was my game.
Yeah. Who was your person? Your main?
I could go to Blanca. I could go to Guile. Ken was also a good one. Ken's a faster Ryu.
Yeah, but his moves are not as strong.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's agility versus strength.
Yeah. I liked we had a cracked version. Me and my brother used to hang out in a comic book shop, and they had a cracked version of Street Fighter 2. I think it had some weird sub name like Turbo or Extra, but it wasn't something that Capcom actually made, because a lot of people just fabricated their own Street Fighter boards, and those cabinets ended up everywhere, and like most of them aren't legit. Like most of them are somebody either messing with an existing Capcom board or just building their own. But yeah, I always like to play M. Bison.
Yes.
Because he has like long range moves that are different than everybody else's.
Yeah. Vega's also like that.
Yeah. They took a lot of that out though in the Super version.
I know in the arcade version, you couldn't play those characters.
Yeah.
They were the boss.
Yeah.
Do you have any other thoughts on like the Ampere experience and you here in the summertime? And
oh, it's been great. Yeah. No, I mean, Ampere just has a great culture in general. They made it really easy to meet a bunch of different people, both coworkers here and in other sites. And we had that tour, so we got to meet interns at other companies too and talk with them. We've had a couple outings like team-wise as like a team bonding thing, and those have been really nice. I know we have one scheduled, I think, for next
meeting
week too.
Meeting off in 2 weeks. Yeah. No, next week.
Yeah. So that's been really cool. And just, yeah, the culture just in general, everyone's really nice and welcoming. And I know, like, my first week here, we just went across the street, and that was my first time just eating at a restaurant in Portland. And it was also, like, my first outing company-wise, like, as a career kind of, like, thing. And that was just really cool to be a part of. And Portland in general, I mean, you can just walk. I mean, I walk to work every day, so it's cool to just see all of the different things that you can do in Portland on your way. There's a plant store I walk by sometimes on the way back, and that's dangerous because I buy too many plants.
Yeah, take them with you when you go back to school.
I know. Pack them in a U-Haul.
How about your projects? Do you feel like you've been given meaty projects that are useful?
Yeah. I've really enjoyed the projects I've done. They've both been, I think they were just kind of like the perfect projects for an intern because they were small enough that they, like, if I needed help or needed someone to, like, look something over, manage it, it's easy to catch mistakes that, you know, someone can make when they don't have a ton of experience, like, especially in this industry. But they also are, like, real projects that once they're done are actually going to be used for something. And they taught me a lot. I got to learn tolerance analysis, which is something that is really important here that we're not taught at all in our curriculum. So that's a skill that I've learned specifically from this company and nowhere else. And so that was really cool. And learning some new softwares, and yeah, it's been nice.
One of the things I know that you are also working on is you're working with a vendor.
Yes.
And you have a chance to, like, talk with them. So I remember when I was just out of undergrad, I was working in a startup company and I was doing board design, and I needed some, like, Molex connector or rocker switch. I forget what it was, but I asked the vendor to come, and it blew my mind that, like, they show up and they're wearing a suit and they have all their wares in front of them and all the different colors and stuff. And I was there just in a shorts and a t-shirt, and I'm like, oh my God, like, one, my company is giving me the responsibility of talking with the vendor and choosing something that's going to be relevant in our design. So you have this experience now. How does it feel to give you have this agency?
Mm-hmm. It's been, I don't really know how to describe my feelings on it because there's just so many different ones. There's the just trying to learn because it's a rigid flex solution to the TTV. It is the TTV. And so first I had to learn what that even was because I didn't know starting off what, I didn't know rigid flex existed. And then Shamil and I, another intern, were actually in charge of finding a vendor. So it wasn't like we had someone that Ampere is like, yeah, we know this person, go talk to them. It was like we had to find a vendor and establish a relationship with this person, which I did. And yeah, then they just kind of told me, you know, own this, come if you have questions, but this is your project. And I was like, that's when I was like, wow, I'm actually, like, managing something, kind of. It was pretty cool. But there have been some communication issues with it just because, you know, it is over email. They're not in state. There's no physical, like, communication like you had. It's all phone calls or meetings and emails. But overall, I think it's been a good experience. I'm learning a lot about how to clearly communicate over emails and then also how to, like, schedule meetings with a team and lead those meetings, which... It's interesting because I know Josh and I were talking about just goals for the internship, and one of them is getting some presentation experience. And I've gotten some good presentation experience, but scheduling meetings and leading them, I think, is kind of a different type of presentation experience. Yeah. And I'm glad I've gotten to have that too, because it is different than just having a time slot and saying your piece. So, yeah. I think that's been that one and Tar River, weirdly, have been my favorite projects so far. Tar River, just because it was my first one, and I felt like that kind of helped me understand most about what our team was doing.
Can you share more about Tar River and what that project was about?
Sure. So Tar River was a BMC board, and then it got changed into an adapter board for San Joaquin and Pajaro, which are DCSCM boards. It's an adapter from 2.0 to 1.0, I believe. So basically all I was doing was taking an old board originally and then putting it into a new project in our software and then sending it to layout to make sure that it was, you know, all the components were where they were supposed to be. But then when it got changed to an adapter board, I ended up having to swap all of the components. And that, along with another board I was doing, gave me a lot of experience with SolidWorks software and also just communicating with the layout team. But since Tar River was my first board, it helped me kind of, I think, bond with Josh a little bit because he had to do so many reviews of this board just to get it up to like what our normal like export would be because I hadn't done a board outline before. But yeah, I think Tar River's connected me most to like coworkers in other locations because it, you know, I had to talk to layout, which most of them are in, you know, overseas. And then I'm talking with Jordan because it connects directly to his boards. And then also talking to just other people in our team to learn exactly, you know, what the adapter board needed to be and like what we needed to do to make it work and whether or not the board was even going to be made at one point. So, which I think is still a little up in the air, but yeah, it's just like this little board. And also that was the first time I actually saw a board because we went into the lab and Josh gave me kind of a board that it was based on that was fried and wasn't working anymore. And he goes, yeah, just put it on your desk. You can see the connectors there. And I was like, oh, that's what I'm working on. Okay.
Yeah. It's always hard to like recognize the scale. It's always the same size on your computer screen.
Right. Yep.
Whether it's a server, a car, a cell phone, whatever you're working on, it's always the same size. So it helps to have that physics.
Yeah, yep. It really did.
That's a really big deal. That saves us so like, we don't have to build a BMC board for that new generation at all.
Yeah.
So we took like probably $1,000 board and you turned it into like $100 board. And now we cover both generations of that OCP spec. And, you know, we can still reuse the BMC board from the last generation. That's a really, really good savings of money and time.
Mm-hmm. And it's also been nice because since it interacts directly with another board, it's been nice to like see how you collaborate to like bring two different projects that two people have been working on together and make sure that they're interacting correctly. I know Jordan had to do a tolerance analysis. We had to find standoffs that were the correct height for the connector that we were using. Yeah, there's been some cabling issues. There's been connector part number issues. Yeah. But just working all of those out is a lot of fun to do, I think. Just problem solving. That's what engineers do. And so yeah. That's what I enjoy doing.
Very cool. And it sounds like it had a big impact on the bottom line, too.
Yeah.
$900 savings per board.
Per validation platform.
Per validation platform. Okay. Good. All right. Thanks so much, Kate and Josh. It was really great having you in the studio to talk about some of the stories of board design, mechanical engineering, and thermal solutions. I learned a lot. And I do want to share that I've just been really jazzed to have both of you join me here in the studio. When we started the Ampere Amplified podcast, we didn't think it was going to last for so long, but we're now pushing 25 episodes. And it's just a real privilege to be able to share this experience with both of you. It's something really special, and I don't think we've seen other companies do anything like this. You know that one of the things that I value is communications and being able to share and uplift others in the ability and techniques of communication. This is one of the things that I really like doing. And so thank you so much for coming on board and sharing your story and being part of this. This is part of history.
Well, thank you for having us on. It's been fun to be part of this podcast.
Yeah, this was really fun. Thank you, Kate, for joining us in this. Thank you, Mahesh, for putting this all together and bringing all of your equipment and setting everything up. I had a good time.
Cool. Thank you so much, and we'll see you again next time. Mm-hmm.